Okay, we're back, and we're going to start chapter 3. So I have some really interesting things to talk about in relation to how Christians treat this passage and how Jews treat the passage, but we'll just proceed a verse at a time until we get into some of the citations that Paul uses from the Tanakh, and then we're going to jump over to Hebrew and look at those and see how he handles those citations. So it's going to take us a little while just to get through the first 18 verses because he does a lot of, he relies a lot on understanding what's going on in the Tanakh in order to justify his argument. So let's just start off with the beginning of the text in verses 1 and 2. And now I realize, I only have what I need. Okay, so 1 and 2 of chapter 3. So I'm just going to read it in the NESV, and then we'll make the comments. Then what is the advantage, or what advantage do the Jews have? Or what is the benefit of circumcision? So notice that for him to talk about what's happening with the Jewish community, he uses circumcision as the identifier. Not, it's not just an ethnic version that he's talking about. He's talking about the symbolic representation of the covenant commitment, right? Because that's what circumcision is. Obviously, it doesn't apply to females, but it doesn't matter because circumcision isn't, from the perspective of the believing community, circumcision isn't a physical only act. It's the symbol of that relationship that God established with Abraham that now continues through the Jewish community. So Paul starts off by saying, oh, you know what? He's now, you remember at the end of 2, he's saying, oh, look, there's all kinds of problems with trying to understand how one community versus another is associated with the law, and the argument about whether the Gentiles who do the things that are correct according to the law without knowing the law are recognized by God for doing that anyway. So what advantage would there to be is there for being Jewish? And that's what he wants to start and address at the beginning. So we expect the answer from this question. What then is the advantage for the Jew? What and who cares about circumcision? We expect the answer to be, well, there isn't any advantage because he's just finished in the first or the second chapter talking about how what good is it do to have the Torah if you don't live accordingly from the Jewish perspective? And Gentiles who don't have the Torah and live accordingly without even knowing it are still considered righteous by God. So what advantage to the Jews? But his answer in verse 2 is really important. He says, great in every respect. That's the NASB translation. And what he's really saying is, okay, you thought that I was proceeding down a line that would say there's no particular advantage to being Jew or Gentile. After all, it's circumcision of the heart, right? Which would be pretty much the way that the Christian church has understood that relationship. And then, but Paul stops us in verse 2 and says, wait a minute. The Jews had a great advantage or have a great advantage, right? First of all, he says, they were the ones who were entrusted with the oracles of God. Okay, so I want to stop there and talk a little bit about what that means. Because we're not familiar today with the word oracle. We don't generally consider that any part of our instruction comes from some oracle. But in the first century, particularly in the first century in the Hellenistic world, oracles were quite famous and were consulted on a fairly regular basis. You remember the very famous oracle at Delphi, which we've talked about in the past. The idea is that an oracle was a location and a relationship where some particular person had a direct connection with a divine and experienced some kind of communication with the divine, which was then interpreted by a prophet so that the person requesting information from the oracle could understand what the divine being was saying. So in Greek thought, there were two people involved in an oracle. The manic, who had the direct relationship with divinity, and the prophet, who interpreted what the manic experienced or what the manic said, because the manic often talked in a language that no one understood or had some experience that was unexplainable without the interaction of the prophet. And by the way, you see the same kind of thing happening in the Tanakh as well, all the way back into the Genesis account. Remember the story of the two sons in the womb, and Rebecca goes to consult with God as to why she's having all this struggle before these sons are born. And in the Tanakh, the word that's used there is a word that's commonly used for oracle. So while we think of the Genesis account in a way that where we interpret it in our modern understanding as though she prayed to God to get an answer about what was happening with her pregnancy, that's not what the Genesis account says. What it actually says is that she consulted an oracle, and in that consultation, God told her about the younger serving the, or the older serving the younger, etc. Okay? So that idea of consulting some person or going to some place where there was a direct connection with divinity is very, very old. Anyway, in the first century, it would have been very familiar to a Gentile Hellenistic audience. And so Paul uses that term in Greek. But it doesn't mean that Paul's talking about the entire corpus of the Tanakh, because oracle literally by the first century meant the sayings of, the short sort of cryptic sayings. You see this, there's another passage in the Tanakh where that's also cited by Paul. It's cited in translation, of course. But in the original, it says the dark sayings. And so what it's really saying is that there are these statements. We can find some of them in Proverbs, by the way, that they're like the very famous Greek stories where an oracle gives a prediction that doesn't seem like it makes any sense at all until the rest of the story unfolds and you find out that the prediction from the divinity actually comes about in ways that usually have a nice twist in them. You can think of the Oedipus story, for example. Okay, so what Paul's saying here is that the Jews had these short sayings, these cryptic sayings from God, and they were the only people who were entrusted with that revelation. What Paul is basically saying, he's not saying that God didn't work with other people. What he's saying is that the oral communication, the written communication between the divine and between the divine and human beings was exclusively a Jewish possession. It's something that God chose to work through that population. So when he says great in every respect, first of all, they were entrusted with the oracles of God, he's really talking about the revelation that made up all the sayings that God provided in the writings, the Pentateuch and the prophets, right? Now he says, what then? So they had them. So verse 3, what then? They had them. Why does that make any difference? Because look what he says. If some of them did believe or did not believe, does that mean that the whole oracular history is subject to collapse, or is not to be taken seriously? Because what he's saying, of course, is that Gentiles in the Hellenistic world would have known that the Jews didn't always follow God's instruction. So what Paul's commenting on is, if they had the instruction and the fact that they don't follow it, does that make it any less important? And his argument, of course, is of course not. Because just because the Jews who were entrusted with the oracles didn't follow the instruction doesn't mean that the instruction was not good. It didn't come with the divine approval, right? And in fact, he makes that argument really, really strong with his statement in verse 4. May it never be. In Greek, this couldn't be any stronger. It's as though he stamps his foot down and shakes his fist and says, are you kidding me? This is absolutely unthinkable. Right? That's the strength of may it never be. You'll see it show up in some of Paul's other letters as well. What he's saying is, if you believe that just because the Jews didn't follow the Torah exactly as it was revealed, the Torah is not, the standard, then you're completely mistaken, because God is faithful regardless of whether or not people obey. All right? And then he says, rather, let God be found true, though every man be found a liar. And now he's going to cite a reference to give the authority for that claim. And the claim, of course, is that what God says is true no matter if no one follows it. Okay? And you'll see in your notes that I have here, I want to talk about the word for truth, aletheis, in Greek, because it's really actually a pretty interesting word. Actually, he says, we should look at the entire phrase. The English doesn't carry the force of Paul's declaration. In Greek, Paul says, let it be God be true. Paul is answering the question, if someone does not believe, does it mean that their disbelief destroys faith in God? And he shouts, never, never. Okay? Now, let's take a look at the word for truth in Greek, aletheia. Aletheia is a really interesting word because Plato uses that word to demonstrate his proof in the Socratic dialogues that truth is always known. It just has to be uncovered. In other words, in Greek, aletheia means not to forget. A is the letter A at the beginning of a word is the negation of the word. So, like, if I took leto, which is the Greek word for forget, I would have not forgetting. And Socrates uses that to show, in fact, in one of his dialogues, he takes a slave boy and he, under Socratic questioning, demonstrates that the slave boy knows all of these incredible mathematical theorems just by asking the right question. And of course, Plato's belief is that knowledge was imparted to the soul of a person before birth, and at birth, all of that information was clouded. It's there, it's internal to you, but all that is required is for the right questions to bring it out. It's very much the same as the rabbis who at the same time were saying that every child in the womb knows the entire Torah. But when they're born, they instantly forget it. And then they have to be reminded of it. They have to relearn it. Okay? Same idea. So when Paul talks about truth, aletheia, in the Hellenistic world, that would have been a key to say, as he says in chapter 1, for example, you all knew what the truth was. You just either ignored it, denied it, or forgot it. Right? Remember when he says, the heavens declare God's glory, and you should have acknowledged him as a sovereign. And because you didn't acknowledge him, which means, by the way, that you recognized that he was sovereign, but you either ignored, denied, or forgot, right? Then all these other things happen until we get to chapter 1, verses 17, 18, which are the consequences, okay? So Paul's point in this citation is to show his Hellenistic audience that their philosophy actually endorses what he's saying, which is that God had imparted this oracular instruction to every human being, regardless of whether or not they actually obeyed it. And since it was already inherent in their constitution as a human being, they should have known this, right? That's the general approach that he's going to take. And he uses this verse that he's going to quote from Psalm 51:4. To back up his claim to show that he has provided a scriptural authority, which is the same as saying there is an oracle that justifies my argument, right? So in a Gentile world, in the assembly in Rome, there are both Gentiles and Jews. If he cites from Psalms, the Jewish population already viewed Psalms as an authoritative text. So he doesn't have to prove to them that if he can show a reference in the Tanakh, he's doing what we call halakha, which is a binding commitment on the community. The Jews would accept that. But on the Gentile side, he's also making a really interesting point. You Gentiles who recognize the Platonic construction of aletheia, which is not to forget, already know in what he's arguing is you already know inside. And all I have to do is show you what has happened in the Tanakh so that you will recognize the truth of what you already knew, but simply either forgot or denied or ignored. Okay? So in either case, citing the Psalms as his proof text will work for both audiences. Okay? It doesn't require just the Jewish audience to confirm that David provides an understanding of what God's requirement is on all men, right? Even the Gentiles will recognize this because of their philosophical orientation via Plato, okay? Michael, did you have a question? Yes.
Does that mean that, is Paul just using that as an argument for the Gentiles, or is he actually teaching that Plato was right and that we do have, you know, this inborn knowledge?
Okay. I would say it like this. Paul isn't saying that Plato was right. Paul's saying that God is right and Plato just recognized it, right? I mean, from the Gentile world, there's often the argument that, and even the rabbis make this argument, that Moses and Plato sometimes say the same thing. But the question is, where did it originate? And from a Jewish perspective, the origin of the idea comes from the oracles of God. And Plato is simply recounting or developing one of those ideas. In fact, they would say Moses instructed Plato, as if that were possible, right? But the point is, for Paul, the point is that both audiences, both Gentile and Jewish audiences, have this idea built into their culture. So he's not telling them anything new. He doesn't have to go on with a proof to show that this is the case, because what he's really saying is both of your cultures, both of your histories support this idea. So when I quote from the Psalms, it will be equally applicable to the Gentiles who are now part of the assembly and the Jews who are part of the assembly, right? Not simply because the Gentiles are now part of the assembly and they have to accept what's in the Tanakh, but because of their own cultural background, they would have been already primed to hear what Paul now cites from the Psalms and say, oh yeah, I agree. Okay? It makes sense to me. Okay? So now let's look at the verse that he cites, because this is important as well. And I have it in Psalm 51:4 in the New American Standard. And the verse is, and you will recognize this verse if you know anything about Psalm 51, against you and you only I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge. Okay? So what he's saying is, here's a verse from David which shows us that David in his sin acknowledged that even though he had not been obedient, God was justified in his assessment of David and in his punishment of David. Okay? But now let's go back and look at the Hebrew, because this is important, right? Paul obviously expects his audience to understand what's going on in the Hebrew text, so let's take a look. So you remember the context of the psalm, right? Psalm 51, very, very important psalm, used in Christian circles to be a proof text for the idea of original sin, which I think is a mistake. But nevertheless, we should be familiar with it. Remember, it's the song that David writes after Nathan the prophet confronts him about his relationship with Bathsheba and prior to God's punishment that ultimately ends up in the death of the child. Okay, so you remember that very, very famous line, often misquoted, In sin did my mother conceive me. Remember that? That's the King James Version, and that's used to proof text the idea that everyone is born a sinner. Okay? I think it's a big mistake, and now I've talked about that in my Today's Word stuff, so you can look that up if you're interested. But that's not the verse that that Paul cites. Paul cites the subsequent verse where David justifies God's actions against him, even though he's been disobedient. What he says is God is perfectly right to do this, to take this action. So let's look. What he says, against you, and you only have I sinned. Okay, so the word there for only is bad. And it means, it's the same word, this is really interesting. It's the same word, badad, that's used for it's not good for man to be alone, and that's used for when Jacob crossed the river and he was alone. Okay, so it clearly doesn't mean by himself. It means that he is separated from, he's isolated, he's cut off. Okay, now with that in mind, I've heard many Christian commentators or Christian preachers say, how can this verse be true? Against you and you only have I sinned, because in fact David's sin involved Bathsheba, involved the community, involved the court, involved the Uriah, involved the army, all of the complicit parts of it that when David initiated this action, it spilled over into everybody else's lives. So how can he say against you and you only? And if you understand badad or bad, you will recognize that what David is saying is, my sin separated me from you. It isolated me from you. And that relationship is the most fundamental relationship of my life. So my sin was against that relationship, right? All the other relationships are subsequent to it. All the other relationships are the consequence of breaking this one. Okay? So against you and you only doesn't mean that David thinks that the only one who mattered in this whole fiasco was God. But what he's saying is that the most important relationship upon which everything else is built was fractured. Okay? Now, he goes on. And done what is evil in your sight. But in Hebrew, it actually says, what is evil in your sight I have done. Okay? And the word for evil there is the regular word for evil in Hebrew, ra. Okay? What's important is to recognize that the syntax of Hebrew places the emphasis on something other than the subject, David. Right? Because look what he says in English, it says, and done what is evil in your sight, which places the emphasis on me, David. I've done what was evil in your sight. But in the syntax in Hebrew says, and what was evil in your sight, I have done. In other words, the most important part of the statement is what he did in God's eyes. It's evil according to God. Right? The emphasis is on that part, not on him as the actor. We have it just the other way around. We think that David is repenting of his act, but what David is acknowledging is the affront, the violation of the relationship with God. That's the most important thing. Now he says in the rest of the verse, so that you are justified, and the word there is tzaddik. Remember we had this, tzaddikah, right, to be justified. It's the same word for righteous. It means to be in right relationship. So he says, so that you are justified when you speak. In other words, he's saying, look, it's all on me. There was nothing that happened that you initiated that caused this. It's all on me. And as a result of that, you are righteous. That is, you are completely exonerated from anything that you want to do according to my action. In other words, I have to accept whatever you say because I'm the one who is fully responsible. And that's the last part of the verse. And blameless when you judge. And the word for blameless there is zakah, and it means to be pure, to be clean, right? There's no part of this relationship, there's no part of God's judgment on David that places any blame or any accountability or any culpability. Okay? All right. So why is that important, that verse important? You will see what happens when he cites all the rest of the prophets and a whole bunch of, no, he cites Isaiah and a whole bunch of other verses from the Psalms at the end of this section. But notice that he set it up now to say, David is the one who shows that God is completely justified and absolutely blameless in whatever punishment he wants to bring when there's been a violation of the relationship. Okay? So let's go to the next couple of verses so that we can see what happens in this long citation at the end of the, that begins on verse 10. Okay?
Yes. Yeah, I just thought it was real interesting where you had in your comments there, but the Bible sees true as a description of a person. Above all, true means faithful. And I think of, you know, John's description of Yeshua, you know, I am the way and the truth and the life. You know, he is true. You know, he's a person.
Yeah, and I think I made that comment because I didn't want people who are going through the notes to think that true in this case means a cognitive affirmation, right? It's not like true and false on an exam. Okay, I got the correct answer. This is true because it's about relationship. So what it means is steadfast, faithfulness, an affirmation of the connection, right? And that's, of course, what David is bemoaning, that he's lost the connection, okay? Okay, and of course, that Psalm 51:4 backs up what Paul is trying to argue, which is that if we're really going to understand how the Jews had an advantage, we first have to understand what happens in the relationship and the trust that God put in them, and then we have to see that God is blameless and justified even if the Jewish community doesn't follow the instructions that were given, right? And he uses this verse to support that. Okay, but let's keep going because now he's going to raise another straw man argument. So he says in verse 5, but if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? I'm speaking in human terms. And what he's setting up the argument that goes like this. Listen, if we weren't sinners, God couldn't be merciful. And because being merciful enhances God's status, how can he punish us for doing things that make him look better? Do you understand the argument? Right? I mean, if I weren't a sinner, God wouldn't have anything to do. So if I want to make God look better, I sin so that he can forgive me, and then I magnify God because look at how fabulous he is, right? It's sort of like, I don't know if you're aware of the prayer of Manasseh. I've talked about this a few times, maybe not with this group. I would suggest that you go on the web and you download the prayer of Manasseh. Now, the prayer of Manasseh is a pseudepigraphical work from sometime around the first century BCE or the first century CE. It's put in Manasseh's mouth as though he actually said the prayer, but it was obviously written much, much later. Okay? But then the question is, why was the prayer put in Manasseh's mouth? Well, what do you know about Manasseh? Tell me what you know about the king Manasseh. How did he rank among the other kings?
He was the worst.
He was wicked.
The worst.
He was the worst of them all. That's the whole point. Manasseh was the most horrible king of the kings following David. Okay? So the prayer, what's interesting about the prayer of Manasseh, and by the way, if you read the account of Manasseh, you'll see that there's a one verse, or maybe there's two verses where it says, toward the end of his life, he repented. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the prayer of Manasseh is a pseudepigraphical work to demonstrate what Manasseh's repentance looked like. And the prayer is really interesting because it goes on and on and on about the, you know, magnificence of God and how wonderful he is and how the ancestors, the patriarchs were blessed by God and on. And finally, about three quarters of the way through the prayer, Manasseh says, listen, if I repent and you forgive me, your status will be enormous because I was the worst of them all. And if you can forgive the worst of them all, how much greater will your glory be? The same idea that Paul is picking up here about the straw man who argues, you know, God really needs us to sin because if we weren't sinners, God wouldn't have the ability to forgive us, and then God's status would be diminished. Okay? So that's what he's starting off with on 5, right? But if the unrighteous demonstrates the righteousness of God, that is, if being a sinner shows how fabulous God is, right, then what shall we say? Why would God punish you for doing something that makes him look better? Okay? He says, I'm speaking in human terms, of course, because his argument has nothing to do with what Scripture says. He's just posting this straw man to show you what the insanity of an argument that says, well, sin is okay because it makes God look good. Okay? Then he says in 6, oh, what did I say in 5? Okay, let's go to 6. May it never be. There it is again, right? The Greek phrase that says, are you kidding me? You have got to be nuts to think like this. Okay? So, he says, may it never be. For otherwise, how will God judge the world? Well, wait a minute. I thought we were talking about the individual says, hey, God, like Manasseh, oh, my gosh, if you forgive me, it'll be fabulous for you because your status will go up. Why does Paul answer, if this is the case, how would God judge the world? Right? What's the assumption? That the sovereign God is the judge of all mankind, period. And so, if you get into the argument that says, well, you need unrighteousness in order for righteousness to show up, you've missed the whole point of what it means to be the sovereign of all creation. Okay? This is like the argument that says, you need to, in order to understand good, you have to have evil. In order to understand right, you have to have wrong. Right? So if I live in a world where there's no wrong and there's no evil, then there wouldn't be any meaning to right and good. Therefore, there must be evil and wrong in the world for me to understand what good and right is. Okay? We go all the way back to Maimonides, who has an argument about what happens with the first commandment in Genesis. Okay? And what he argues is this. The commandment that God gives to Adam cannot be a commandment about cognitive affirmation. And you know what the commandment is? The commandment is, of all the trees in the garden you may freely eat, but of this tree you may not eat. Okay? Now, the whole point is, Adam has to know the difference between right and wrong in order to understand that commandment. Okay? He has to know that doing what God says is right and not doing what God says is wrong. He has to know that or the commandment doesn't make any sense. But that's not the same as saying that the commandment is an ethical requirement, right? At the point where the commandment is given, it's a cognitive issue. It's the knowing the difference between what is right, doing what God says, and what is wrong, not doing what God says. The act of disobedience brings the ethical and moral into play, right? And Maimonides' argument, of course, is that Adam had to know and had to have a conscious understanding of right and wrong, but he didn't have to know the difference between good and evil. Right? That he discovers experientially. So, Paul, reflecting on perhaps what's happened with the Genesis account, can say, if you don't have a God who governs, or who not only governs, but judges the whole world, if you don't have that, then the whole notion of right, wrong, good, and evil goes out the window. Okay? If you exile God from the universe, right and wrong becomes whatever you want. But if there's a sovereign God, then right and wrong, good and evil follow what the sovereign God dictates, not what you think. So your argument that he needs sinners in order to be magnified misses the whole point. He doesn't need anything to be magnified because he is the creator of everything. And for Paul, that means the mountains clap their hands, the rivers jump for joy, the trees sing, you know, all that kind of, and God is magnified in everything that he does, right? So I don't need to have people, sinners, who are disobedient in order to magnify God. He's already magnified because he is the sovereign of everything, okay? So the argument falls apart as far as Paul is concerned. And he says, but If through my lie the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I also being judged as a sinner? Okay? And this is the straw man. Wait a minute. If the fact that I disobey, the fact that I'm you know, in this case he uses liar, but it could be if the fact that I'm acting in ways that are disobedient, if that makes God look better, then why am I being punished? And Paul's argument, of course, is you're being punished because the sovereignty of God judges the world according to his standard. It doesn't make any difference. He doesn't need you to act disobediently in order to fulfill his role as the sovereign. Okay? So, and Paul continues this. And there's a point behind all this argument, and we'll get to that in a second. Okay? And why not say, as we are scandalously reported, and some affirm that we do say, let us do evil that good may come. Their condemnation is just. Okay, so there's two things going on in this verse, and I'm going to refer you to another book in a second. The first thing that's going on in this verse is the conclusion of the straw man's argument, which is, listen, why in the world, why wouldn't we say, let's do bad things so that God can look better? Okay? And of course, Paul's answer to that is, their condemnation is just. He doesn't even respond to the idiocy of the argument. He simply says that God will treat them in a way that shows their insolence and their arrogance and their disobedience. So Paul's rebuttal to the argument is, wait and see. Right? But now there's a phrase in here that I want to talk about that's really interesting. Okay? And why not say, and then there's this parenthetical remark in the NASB, as we are slanderously reported and some affirm that we say. Okay? So here's the question. Do you suppose, well, first we have to understand what is the parenthetical remark about? As we are slanderously reported and some affirm that we say. In other words, some people are saying of Paul and another company, whatever, we're going to look at that in a minute, that Paul, in fact, is arguing exactly this point, that we should be evil so that God can be magnified in his goodness. Okay? And he says, as some people slanderously say to us. Okay, so now the question is, who would say that? And why? Okay? So now let's back up. Romans is the last of Paul's letters, which means that we have an accumulative theology beginning probably with some of the early letters to individuals and working our way through the letters to the groups, Ephesians, Corinthians, Thessalonians, etc., until we get to Rome. Along that path, we know the history from the book of Acts, along that path, some people have accused Paul of being antinomian, right, against the law. Who were those people? I ask. And you're going to raise your hand and say, ah, I know where that comes from. What letter of Paul's particularly addresses the people who claim that he was antinomian?
Galatians.
Galatians, right. Because in Galatians, he says, this group came from Jerusalem arguing that Paul was providing a theology that would not only just allow the Gentiles in, but allow the Gentiles in under any circumstances at all. And what they were claiming is that Paul was acting against the law. And of course, Paul's response was, I'm not acting against the law. I'm opening the door for anyone who accepts the Messiah on the basis that, as James and Peter told them later in Acts 15, on the basis that they give up their idolatry, and they come into the community where they learn Moses. Okay? So, and in fact, James says, okay, Paul, I want you to go to the temple and pay for this vow to demonstrate that you are actually Torah observant and you're teaching them. Okay? But the scandal is that the what we call Judaizers, which is really a faction of the Jewish community that viewed Paul's ability to allow Gentiles into the assembly as something that broke the Jewish law, right? That that the Judaizers were the ones who were claiming that Paul and those associated with him were not just anti-Jewish, but anti-Torah. Okay? So Paul responds to that. Now, and he says, we were sometimes called like that. We were sometimes said that we're doing exactly the same thing as my straw man, that we're claiming that Gentiles can live in any way that they want and still be part of the community. And of course, Paul didn't say that. But I want you to listen to what Leon Morris has to say about this verse, because it's really interesting, and it shows you how paradigms affect interpretation. Okay? So here's what he says. In verse 8, we, who are scandalously reported, are clearly Paul and his Christian associates. And the we in verse 9, who have already made the charge, are just as clearly Christians. Why should we, that comes between them and is so close to them, be understood of someone else? To understand it as we Christians is surely the most natural way of taking it. But my point is, that's the most unnatural way of taking it. Because in fact, not only were there no Christians in that assembly, but the only way that I can read we as Christians is to adopt an understanding of Paul that he never said, that he never expressed. In other words, it's to make Paul into a Christian missionary and everyone that he's associated with Christians as opposed to Jews, right? So here's Leon Morris, this great Greek scholar whose theology now gets in the way of understanding what I think is the natural way, which is we Jewish messianic believers. End of story. Not Christians, but Jewish messianic believers. Okay? Because Paul clearly, look at all the efforts that he's gone to show you that his position is supported by verses from the prophets and the writings. I mean, that's been going on since chapter 1, verse 17, when he quotes from Hosea. Or is it Hosea 2:4? Or is it, I can't remember now.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, the just shall live by faith. What is that? Is that from Hosea? I don't remember now. I have to go back and look. Anyway, the point is he's using citations from the Tanakh to justify his arguments. And in order to do that, he has to believe that the tradition of the Tanakh is also the same one that he's teaching. Okay? Now, that's the setup. Yes.
Yeah. It's Habakkuk, right? Larry.
Oh, Habakkuk. Yeah. Habakkuk. Right. Sorry. Habakkuk 2:4. Okay. How could I forget? Okay. Anyway. Yes, so now notice what Paul's doing, right? In opposition to Leon Morris's view that we must mean Christians, Paul is really setting the stage for everything Jewish is supporting what he's saying, right? And now he's going to go into this long citation. We're going to take a look at these verses and see how he deals with justifying his argument from the Tanakh, okay? So we need verse 9. Oh, sorry. Verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. Okay? We're getting close to the, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, the big famous evangelical verse in 3:23. But right now he's setting up the stage to show that there is a prophetic background to what he's saying. Remember, he started off with the oracles, right? So now he's going to reach back into David and Isaiah and show you that there is proof for his contention that neither Jew nor Greek has any advantage when it comes to the relationship between God and the sinner, because no matter what the circumstances are of the actual behavior, everyone has fallen short of the ultimate standard of the sovereignty of God. Okay? So, let's look at these verses now. And this is 10 through 19. So maybe we'll get to the last of these, I hope. And I just happen to have, you're supposed to have looked at all these, so it won't be any news to you, but I just happened to have printed them all out so I could take a look at the Hebrew behind them, and we'll just walk through them. And what's really interesting is if you've looked at those verses, you'll see some really funny things. And the first thing you're going to see is, if you look at this page, you see what's there in yellow? What's in yellow is what Paul actually cites. In other words, he picks and chooses as he goes along. He might give you one phrase from one verse and then another phrase from another verse from another author. And he bundles them all together. So when you read, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. What you're reading are two or three different sources all piled, smashed together as though they came from one place. Because if you're going to try to find these verses in this order in one place, you can't find it. Right? In other words, it comes from Psalm 14, Psalm 53, Psalm 104, Psalm 10, Isaiah 59, Psalm 36, and Proverbs 1:7. I mean, it's all over the book, right? He's doing what rabbis always did. They found verses that supported what they were trying to say, and they just pulled them out, okay? But when they do that, I've looked at what's the surrounding words so we get an idea what these verses are about. Okay, so let's look at the first one. Verse 10, there's none righteous, no, not one. Okay, there's none righteous, no, not one is found in Psalm 14. It's found in Psalm 53. It's found in, in Isaiah 59. So the same, in fact, sometimes in the Psalms, the same phrase is repeated. So you can find it in more than one place. Okay, so here's the context of Psalm 14. And I'm going to read you 1-3. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Okay, so that's going to show up again in the way that he cites this. And of course, we know that there are three words for fool. And this is the fool who is the Nabal, the worst of them all. The one who not only knows what is right and doesn't do it, but tells other people not to do it. Okay? So that fool, it's all moral. It's never, has nothing to do with mental capacity. It's all about moral capacity. The fool's in his heart, and the phrase is, there is no God. But the actual Hebrew is, I am God not. There is, basically what he's saying is, God doesn't exist. Okay? He's saying basically, God is nothing. All right? And then he says, they are corrupt. And there, it's about relationships. They have committed detestable acts, all of which are relationship-oriented. And then when he gets to verse 3, the end of verse 2 and the beginning of verse 3 in Psalm 14, then we get the citation. To see if there are any who understand, who seek God. And the phrase in Hebrew, there are two words in Hebrew for seek, barash and derash, and they mean two different things. This one, derash, means to seek with your whole heart, with great intensity. Okay. The other one is to inquire. This one is to be absolutely devoted to find it. Okay. And then he says, they have all turned aside. Together they are corrupt. And to turn aside is not the word shuv for return, but it's a word that means to change direction, to retreat, or to fall down. And there's plenty of context there in the Tanakh for all the ideas that involve this particular word. And then he says in the third verse in Psalm 14, there is no one who does good, not even one. And again, not even one is ayin, just like there is no God. In other words, it doesn't exist. Okay. And no one who does good, and the word is tov. Okay. So you're familiar with that. So now look, there is none who seeks God, comes from part of that verse. There is no one who is righteous, right? That comes from part of a verse and another verse that we're talking about. But there is no one who understands isn't even in that psalm. So he's taken one thought from one verse and he adds something else. And he adds what comes up in the next couple of psalms. So now we'll look at 53 as you keep working your way down through his citations. All have turned aside, which we get from this verse, right? Together they have together they have become useless. Okay, that's from Psalm 14, right? But now we get, there is none who does good. There is not even one, which is a repeat. And then, their throat is like an open grave. Okay, and so then I said, okay, where am I going to find that? I got to go look and see if there's any place where I can find that one. And what's interesting is the poison of asps is under their lips comes from Psalm 140, verse 3. But the beginning of the psalm doesn't talk about an open grave. It says they sharpen their tongues like a snake. Okay, so Paul's just taken that one phrase out of Psalm 140 and added, their throat is like an open grave, which we have to find in another psalm or another verse. Okay, so let's see if we can find that someplace. And the closest one is Psalm 10:7. Their mouth is full of cursings, deceit, and oppression. Right, and we find that in verse 14, whose mouth is full of cursings and bitterness. Not the same exactly. In the Psalm 10, it says, his mouth is full of cursings, deceit, and oppression. And now Paul says in Greek, whose mouth is full of cursings and bitterness. Not quite the same. He's modified it, right? In other words, he's translating the Hebrew into his own vernacular for what he's trying to accomplish. And then he says, their feet are swift to shed blood. Okay, so where did that come from? Ah, that comes from Isaiah 59, 7 and 8. Their feet run to evil, and they hurry to shed innocent blood. So you can see that Paul is not exactly quoting it the way that it is. Even when he's combining all of these thoughts, he still is changing the way that the words are put together and doing his own translation of them, right? Then he says, destruction and misery are in their paths. And the verse in Isaiah is destruction and devastation are in their paths. They do not know the way of peace. And he has, and the path of peace they have not known. Okay? So now here's the question. We've got one more to look at. But basically what you see is that Paul is borrowing words and phrases from various places in Scripture, not just from David, but also from Isaiah, and combining those and translating them, not according to what the Hebrew text says, but kind of. It's like Paul is paraphrasing. He's using his own words to describe what Isaiah and David were trying to say. And the question then is, was there no Hebrew equivalent? So Paul had to, you know, make up his own translation as he went along? And the answer is no. There are Hebrew equivalents in Greek for these words. So where is Paul citing them? And for many people, the answer would be, well, Paul's citing from the Septuagint. So we got to take this passage in Isaiah 59, 7, and 8. And we quickly run over to our Septuagint, right? And we check Isaiah 59, 7 and 8 to see if Paul is citing from the Septuagint. Okay? Well, I should have had this already up for you. I'm sorry I didn't. Now I'm going to have to look it up. Let's see. Sorry. Well, maybe I can take the one in Psalms. Yeah, 823. Okay. Hold on. Okay, Isaiah 59. Okay, Isaiah 59, 7 and 8 in the Septuagint. It reads like this. Their feet run to evil, swift to shed blood. Their reasoning and the reasonings of fools, destruction and wretchedness are in their ways, and a way of peace they do not know, and there is no judgment in their ways. Okay, so now let's look at what happens with Paul. Does he actually cite from the Septuagint? Okay, he says, their feet are swift to shed blood. So 59, their feet run to evil, swift to shed blood. So it's not exactly what the Septuagint says either, is it? Then he says, destruction and misery are in their paths. And in the Septuagint, it says destruction and wretchedness are in their ways. Close enough. And then 8, there is no fear of God before their eyes. Oh, sorry, the way of peace. And the path of peace they have not known. And this says, and the way of peace they do not know. So it's close, right? But of course, that's the middle of the paragraph. Then it goes on, and there is no judgment in their ways for their paths, though through which they have traveled are crooked. And Paul leaves all that out. Then he says, there's no fear of God before their eyes, which we can't find in Isaiah at all. And the only place that we can find anything similar is in Psalm 36:1, where it says, there is no fear before their eyes. So Paul has maybe cited something from the Septuagint, which he's modified a little bit. He's clearly pulling verses from all over the place in the Psalms and using phrases and combining them in one thought to justify his argument that there's no point in trying to claim, as the straw man does, that there's any value in sin at all, okay? And he does all that with all of these references until he gets then to verse 19, where he says, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, and that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. But what does that mean for one who's outside the law? Well, Paul's just argued in all of these verses that the law, which is God's instruction to humankind, applies universally. Now, does that mean that God is going to hold everyone in the world accountable for kosher and Shabbat and all and Levirate marriage and everything else? No, that's not what Paul's talking about. Paul's talking about the concept of God's sovereignty expressed in these oracles that were given to the Jews. And as that idea spreads, so will the notion that Torah is the basis for true foundation relationship with God. And if you don't acknowledge that, then you're outside of the relationship between you and the God of Israel, which is really interesting because that's precisely what Leon Morris would have to argue if he says that Paul is referring to a Christian group, because ultimately the Christians left the Jewish Torah law behind. Right? So as Paul goes through all these references in the Tanakh, in my view, what he's doing is he's providing us with an oracular Jewish history that gives strength to his argument that no one is immune from God's judgment upon their behavior, regardless of whether they were given the revelation from Sinai or not. Okay? And ultimately that's where he's going to end up in 3:23. But at this point you can see all of this work that he's doing by taking pieces from all over the Psalms and the Isaiah and ultimately in Proverbs to show us that there's no excuse for the straw man who argues that, he just didn't know. Ultimately he's saying, yeah, that's right. You thought you didn't know, but if you'd really examined your own internal consciousness and if you'd really thought about what was happening in the social environment around you, and if you know anything about what was happening in the Jewish history, you would have to agree that the sovereign God has a right to judge as he feels. Yes, Michael?
Yeah, I just wondered if Paul is not saying, like you said, it's not keeping the law specifically like kosher and all those things, but keeping the concept of love and kindness and justice is the most important.
Okay, you could argue that, and I think you'd be in line with what Paul's argument is regarding Gentiles who have not come into the assembly. Okay, but the point that Paul wants to make is that even Gentiles who agree to the principles that we would find in the Noahide laws, for example, even Gentiles who agree to those principles, love among neighbors, kindness, gentleness, justice for all, et cetera. If you agree to all those, ultimately that's going to force you to acknowledge a sovereign God, because those principles can't stand on their own. They're not the result of a rational ethics. They ultimately depend on revelation. And as soon as you make that step, then everything else follows from it. Because as soon as you make the step that says those basic principles of society, which Plato and Aristotle argue for, right? Those basic principles which hold society together, once you realize that they can't be justified on their own, that you need a revelation like the prophetic text of the Tanakh in order to justify them, as soon as that happens, then you have to have a sovereign then you have to have a lawgiver. Better word, lawgiver than sovereign. Then you have to have a lawgiver. And then you depend on revelation. And as soon as that happens, you have to turn to the Jews, because God has entrusted his oracles to them. And you're right back at the beginning, recognizing that, you know, the God of Israel is the one who's going to hold you accountable. So even if you start with the smallest principle, which is that you should treat people fairly, as soon as you start to analyze what that means, it's going to drive you toward the acknowledgement of a lawgiver. Okay? And that, unfortunately, is the problem with society today. You've exiled God from the society, so you try to build a rational ethics without a foundation in revelation. And what do you end up with? Well, all you have to do is look around and see. You end up with legislated morality, which is no morality at all, because chaos. Every faction will claim its own authority. Right? You end up with exactly what Paul cites here, destruction and chaos. And by the way, one of the words that is in the Hebrew there actually means that. It means, let me see if I can find it real quick. Ah, yeah. When it says devastation and destruction are in their paths from Isaiah, the word for devastation there is haval. It means chaos, right? So it doesn't mean that, and basically what Isaiah is saying is, listen, once you walk away from the revelation from the outside, you end up in this state. And that's what Paul's argument is. You can't avoid ethical chaos once you give up the notion of a lawgiver from outside the box. That's inevitable. Okay? Well, that takes us to the second half of chapter 3, which we'll get tomorrow. But I just want you to recognize what two important things. First, you have to recognize that Paul sees Jews and Gentiles in the same boat. It doesn't matter where they begin. One of them begins with revelation and one of them begins with rational ethics, but they arrive at the same conclusion, that it won't stand without a divine lawgiver. It can't be justified. Okay? That's the first point. The second point is all of the prophetic oracular material and all of the culture of philosophy from the Greeks align in their agreement that this is what has to happen, right? And that no one escapes from this. And it doesn't actually matter how good you are or how great your principles are or what kind of behavioral history you have. At some point, you've messed up. And that's what Paul's going to press now in the second half of 13. Second half of 3. Okay?
Hey, Skip. I think the hardest part, I mean, we can all agree that, you know, we can follow this. But the hardest part is relating the law to today's world. I think that's the hardest thing. I mean, I know that's where the rabbis come in and each community decides what, you know, what works for them. But that's the hardest part, because everything is built on a society that's, you know, 4,000 years old. So when you come to today's world and you say to yourself, well, should I do this? Because, you know, this technology is so advanced. How do I fit this into my life? That's where it becomes difficult. That's where I think you just don't know, because the farther we get into the future, on how we live such a life different than the people that lived 4,000 years ago, the harder it is to distinguish. I mean, the easy stuff is, you know, don't murder, don't, you know, treat people with kindness, and, you know, that's the easy stuff, you know. But the hard stuff is all the little things, the technical things, like they do with the elevator in Israel. I mean, that's when you try to start figuring out, you know, how did those fit in? That's what drives me crazy, you know.
Okay.
I mean, does that really matter?
Yeah, but I think there are two points. First, I take exception to your statement that every community has to figure out on its own. The bottom line is that the general principles which you articulated there, right? Don't murder, don't lie, don't steal, don't bear false witness, et cetera, all those, everybody agrees on that. In fact, no functional society can work without those, right? That's the no hide law kind of approach, okay? But you're right. When it comes to the application of the ordinances and the other parts of the Mosaic law, when it comes to the application of those in the modern world, then you need a community with someone like a rabbi who can show you the linkage between the revelation of Moses or to Moses and the connection to the modern, modern situation. So in essence, the Jewish law is both absolute and conditional. I mean, an absolute law would say, okay, when, for example, there are certain aspects of religious communities which take Paul's instructions to be absolute. So when Paul talks about gold braids in the hair and et cetera, and being effeminate, et cetera, they take that as an absolute. They ignore the fact that it was a cultural problem in Corinth, and they just apply it to everything. Okay? Obviously, that doesn't work. I mean, it works for a community if you buy into it, but it has all kinds of other complications. There are absolutes, however. The absolutes are the fundamental ideas that keep society together and that make relationship possible. But then there's all the other stuff, like not boiling a kid in its mother's milk, okay? And for that, I need a community that trusts the insights of its elders and its Torah scholars to help me understand how that applies. And then I would say, then you have the community decides what that means for itself, but only in those kind of circumstances, right? So there will be communities where it means one thing, and there'll be communities where it means something else, but you're part of the community. So it isn't as though you believe differently. You believe in the text, you're just trying to interpret it according to how your community thinks that should be applied.
Well, that's the thing. And you have to trust your rabbi or whatever and his.
Yeah, or you have to do the work yourself, which is obviously the key.
Even if you do the work yourself, I don't think there's so many ways you could change, in your mind. And then you wonder, well, if I am picking the wrong one, you know, am I going to be punished? Is God going to,
I got that. But think of the history, Phyllis. For Shema and
Hillel
argued for their entire lives, and their schools continued to argue and debate these issues, and it didn't prevent them from accepting each other within the wider religious community, right? It was the active debate that made the community work, right? So you have the same thing. You have an active debate over, well, this is what I think it means, and then someone will challenge you and say, yeah, but what about this word? What about this word? How about that syntax and grammar? This is what I do with the rabbi every week here, right? We sit down, we work on the grammar, we work on the syntax, we work on the Hebrew relation. We're trying, because what are we trying to do? We're trying to seek what it is that God is saying through these things so that we can apply it. Does he apply it in the same way I do? No. But it doesn't matter, because we're part of the same community trying to figure all this stuff out, right? And that's exactly, I think, what will happen in any, you associate yourself with a community that feels like, for you, that it's moving you in the direction of, you know, of a closeness to God, and you trust that community to lead you that way, always with your own process going on all the time to think, how do I understand that, right? Because everybody can be wrong.
Isn't that what the Christian community has done too, though? Trust their leaders to lead them in the right way?
Yeah, except as you and I are discovering, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on in their paradigm that prevents them from actually understanding what's happening in the text in the Jewish world. So my pushback to them is, you guys have missed the point. You started with the text, but your interpretation is so paradigm dependent that when you read "we," you think Christian. But you know that's I raise all kinds of issues about that, because it doesn't seem to me that you can support that from the text. But believe me, there are plenty of Christians who will read Romans 3 as though it was written for Christians. They just have to be open, like I have to be open, to consider thinking about it in a different way, and then see which makes the most sense. Okay, Lindy and Dan both have your microphones on. Are you want to add something?
No, I was just going to add a story that goes along with this. And so just real quick, I'll shorten it. The Shema. The Shema is said in the synagogue. And there's the congregation that says you stand up. And then there's a congregation where you sit down. And so there was an old man. And they would fight. They would fight. You have to say it standing up. You have to say it sitting down. And this is a major, major fight. And so they went to the old rabbi who was in the hospital, and they said, "You have the answer." And he said, so they said, "Do we say it standing up?" And the rabbi says, "Yes." And then, "Do we say it sitting down?" He says, "Yes." The rabbi says, "Yes." And he says, "What's the answer?" He says, "That's the tradition." Does it make sense to you? They make, one says this and one says that. One is right and the other one is also right. So that's the answer to the how do you apply these things today. That's not going to mean, you're not going to be, you know, we don't have a God with a cat of nine tails if you say the Shema standing up. And we don't have a God with a cat of nine tails if you say the Shema sitting down. If you murder someone, then it's a different story. The tradition is, that's the argument. That's the tradition.
Yeah. And I think that the response is, you align, when you join a community, you align yourself with the tradition. And so you adopt the tradition of the community because you believe that that tradition draws you closer to God. If it doesn't draw you closer to God, then you're in the wrong community.
That's right.
Yeah. Robin, you had something? Dan, you had something?
Yeah. I'm thinking about the idea of the trauma of certainty. And then when we get into the certainty side, then that's where the conflict comes and the communities and wars and everything else happens. So,
we're going to get to that, because Paul doesn't avoid that topic, but we certainly have to talk about this whole idea of, you know, I've said many times that you have to give up the willingness to be right, right? Because you can't have dialogue and discussion if you think that you have to be right. But you can understand the tradition and the background and the various interpretations, and then choose the one that draws you closer. Right. Robin?
You mentioned earlier, you said you're going to have you had a book you wanted to recommend to us, but you never mentioned a book. Is it in relation to this, or is it something else? You said I have another book I want to recommend to you, and then you went on to something else.
Oh my gosh, I guess I forgot already.
Okay.
I'll think of another one. Okay. Okay.
You'll remember it tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, the next time it comes up, you have to stop me right there and say, okay, what was it? Okay. Okay. Kate, you had something?
No, I just wanted to thank you for explaining the history about the oracle of the word, and because I have the new translation of the NASB, and it doesn't say oracle in those verses.
Oh, what does it say?
It says, which first that they were entrusted with the actual words of God. So they've taken the Greek out of it.
Yes, no? They have.
Okay. Yeah. So I was like, wait.
Greek out of it. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
And then the second thing that it was just from notes from a different talk that I had listened to. And when we were talking about an excuse that no one's has excuse, it says an excuse is a lie wrapped in disobedience.
Hmm.
And I just thought that was interesting because he used the word liar. And
yes. Yeah, yeah. You
know, it's now, a cover. I think
one of the nice things about going through this text is that you can see that, you know, you have to constantly think Paul is writing to an assembly in Rome that's made up of Hellenists and Jews. And you've got to think how he is managing the words to connect both groups. Yeah. So, okay.
It's interesting when you say Hellenists, because if you came to the scripture without any, even Western sieve, you know, when I hear Hellenists, I just think Greek. I don't think Rome. I don't think Italian. You know, I mean, but that's why I love the way we can dialogue here and learn, because that's not, I was never thought to think that way. I was never taught to think like
that. In the
this.
First century, Rome is Hellenist. It's certainly not Italian. But
exactly.
It doesn't become Italian for another 1700 years.
Perfect. Well, thank you.
Okay, I will see you guys tomorrow at the same time, and we'll continue. We'll finish chapter 3, I'm pretty sure.